Welcome back. The program's called Seldom Said. My name is Robert. Special guest today, Mr. Jeff Clayton, the Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition. Welcome to Seldom Said, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. You have a great deal to say, and we certainly want to hear it. Can you give us a little bit of a personal background kind of review for those who did not receive the last program or who listened to it, but it's a while ago?
Yeah, sure. So my basic background is I was a practicing attorney for 4 or 5 years, represented unionized police officers. Got into government relations and really learned sort of lobbying and government relations while I was representing the Colorado Judicial Department, which is the courts, and the state probation department. So I did that for about 5 years. Was out on my own, had my own firm, and had various clients in government relations capacity. And then I started doing national work for the American Bail Coalition, which is a trade association of surety bail insurance underwriters. I started doing that in May of 2015. So I've been at it for almost 2 years now.
I see. A question that perhaps isn't as imperative as some others, but it's been posited to me, especially after your first program. Colorado, those in the east and west coasts or around the lakes, Chicago and so forth, react to Colorado as a conservative western state dealing with issues that are somewhat different than the major cities that are bi-coastal. How would you react to that?
I don't think Colorado is a conservative state anymore. I think Colorado is a libertarian state. There's a libertarian bent on both sides of the aisle, I would say. And there's, you know, independents, have the same voter registration as Democrats and Republicans. So you really have a third party of independent folks who are libertarian leaning. And you also, you know, you look at the marijuana experiment, to start with. I mean, I think that sort of proves the libertarian bent. Now, in terms of issues, certainly, you know, a third of the land base here is owned by the federal government. So there's a lot going on in terms of like oil and gas leases and you know, other issues that some states don't have. But for the most part, you know, I'd say we're really not that much different.
I've done two programs with the national chairperson of the Libertarian Party trying to get a handle on their approaches to politics and political issues. How does that philosophy impact on your work, Jeff?
Well, in Colorado, you know, I think, civil liberties is really what wins the day on a lot of these arguments. And that's ultimately, you know, when we talked about our issue, it was what was the impact on defendants' rights really was the central concern. What was the impact on the rights of the community was more of the focus than necessarily maybe the costs all the time that, you know, and so I think, you know, it also forces compromise because, you know, you can't be too extreme and you can't deviate too far from sort of that centrist sort of civil liberties mindset.
This isn't then, in your opinion, a zero-sum game?
I'm not sure what you mean by that, but no, I wouldn't say so.
Okay. Just the premise that one wins and one loses and justice triumphs. It seems to be a series of compromises upon compromise.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you know, justice is sort of an abstract concept, and it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. You know, but certain fundamental rights, I think, you know, personal freedoms and that sort of thing is really a Western Colorado mindset, and always has been. I mean, I grew up here, and that's always been sort of, you know, limited government, and I tell people, you know, my tax rates and how much I pay in taxes, and people on the East Coast are shocked at how little it is, and it's probably pay about 10% of what folks pay in property taxes in Pennsylvania, for example.
That is incredible. I've experienced that myself with people saying such things, and one just sits down and looks at their own tax return and figures that it might be a time to move.
Right, exactly.
Since our last interview, Jeff, what have been your activities? What have you been doing?
Well, primarily, you know, we can talk about the Walker case when we get to that. Certainly, we've been monitoring all the lawsuits and what's been going on there. And there's been some activity on that. And really, it's just been the state legislatures that I've been traveling to, meeting with legislators and, you know, other outside organizations to talk about bail reform. And we certainly have, you know, a handful of states that are hot. Obviously, the New Jersey issue is going on right now. That's another thing that's been a big topic of conversation nationally and certainly in New Jersey, given the fact that, you know, really a handful of bails have been written since January 1, causing tremendous pressure on the agents up there. So those are kind of the three main things I've been working on.
The capacity in which you appear at meetings in various venues in various states, given the political climate, is it an easy thing to do, or are you lost in the porridge of everyone else's issues?
Well, I think for me, you know, I've sort of gotten into this sort of national spokesperson role, so I think folks do want to meet with me. This issue is not hard, is not easy to work on either side, just because it's difficult to understand it, first of all. And then, you know, depending on the state, you know, there's sort of could be a general distaste for industry, for industries, for private industry lobbyists, all this sort of thing. So yeah, it's not been easy, but I think, you know, we, in my style, is to try to find common ground and middle ground on some of this stuff to try to move the dial forward, even if people can't, you know, totally radically upend the system, they can at least go.
Are you optimistic to the premise that the system is malleable? Political life lately does not seem flexible at all.
Yeah, I think it's different in state capitals than it is at the federal level. And I think largely that's due to budget realities. And that's certainly what we got a flavor of in California, which was, you know, okay, we're going to create a statewide, county-run pretrial program with risk assessments for everyone. And how much is that going to cost? And then that ends up competing with other priorities. So, you know, I think it is malleable. I think, you know, just the competition for resources is a real one. And for California, for example, let's say the price tag was $1 billion. We don't know what it is, but let's say it was. You know, do you want to spend it on that, or is it better spent on, you know, diversion programs and drug treatment and things like that? So,
when you use that phrase risk assessment, it seems a somewhat nebulous term. Risk assessment involving threats to people's lives, involving larcenous activities. Where do you draw the line yourself?
You know, I'm not a real proponent of the computerized justice system. I think everybody agrees with me on that. And that's just a tradition that was brought to me by a former Chief Justice of the Colorado Supreme Court who I worked for, who was also not a fan of these. And I just sort of bought in to his arguments that judges need to do their job and stop relying on the security blanket of these. But, you know, what they're able to do is essentially look at factors that they can kind of score and try to determine, you know, how likely a person is to fail to appear or to commit another crime while they're out on bail. Not that good.
Are you of the opinion that there should be a stratified criteria that judges use, or on the opposite side of the coin, very liberal judges? We had a judge in New York, for instance, who was just nicknamed Let Him Loose. His criteria was so incredibly flexible, it depended on the moment of the day. Do you believe in solid criteria?
You know, generally, I think we do. I think there should be some restriction on judicial discretion. I mean, otherwise, it's just what is sufficient sureties could be defined as anything. And I think it is a legislative prerogative to define the substantive aspects of criminal law. And I think bail is one of those. What should be the bail for what crime? And obviously, it's a fine line between, you know, how far the legislature wants to go to force it, you know, in terms of judges. But I would say, you know, having some sort of guide rails is a good idea.
Would you be of the opinion that it should be in some way stratified to indicate that bail for crimes that involve physical harm are different in their criteria and obviated any need to consider them other than as physical crimes, whereas a larcenous crime is somewhat different? You're dealing just with loss of money and properties?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, you know, when there's a real victim and there's violence involved, that it calls for a different approach than, you know, when people are in, you know, a lot of cases where people are just a harm to themselves, right? And do we really need to put bails on them, you know, once they cease to become a harm to themselves or if they're intoxicated, for example? So I definitely think you want to take, you know, violence into account when setting bail, and the protection of the public is a central focus of that.
Now, we mentioned the Walker case, and it certainly leads us directly into a discussion of the Attorney General, Eric Holder. What was your opinion of Holder's action in regard to that case?
Well, you know, we thought it was bullying by the U.S. Justice Department, and certainly we've told the new Justice Department that, you know, look, if these local jurisdictions want to have, bail, they're allowed to do it within the contours of the Constitution, and that's up to them. And you shouldn't be spending federal taxpayer dollars to try to force them to go in one direction or the other. And frankly, you know, a lot of people in our industry say, hey, you know, that this is an opportunity where we can force the other side of it. And the answer to that is no. The federal government shouldn't be involved in local bail policy, period, is the way I feel about it. And it's just unfortunate that, you know, the merits of the conversation get lost in a big name like Eric Holder when he joined it. And I think it gave too much momentum to a movement that shouldn't have quite this much momentum.
Taking that a step further, does that indicate a feeling that bail laws should be primarily autonomous? Because what is a crime in Kansas would be different than what is a crime in Brooklyn, New York.
Exactly, and I think that's important to look at. I mean, you look at, well, Colorado again, possession of marijuana here, you know, is encouraged, adds to the tax base, and the possession of the same amount could be a felony in any number of states. So, yeah, it really does depend on, and also local practice. You know, what are the arrest policies? What do we arrest people for and what do we not arrest people for? And you may not arrest, you may be a jurisdiction that doesn't arrest people. You cite and release classes of offenders that you don't take to jail because you know they're just going to get a promise to appear, so why bother with it? Well, then your numbers look bad because you got a bunch of people in jail that can't afford it and they're high bails and all that kind of stuff, but they're high risk. And so you got to look at each jurisdiction's numbers and practices before you can really diagnose if there's a problem.
That's interesting. It really seems a bit of a duck soup, very hard to make some sense out of the scenario unless you really just revert to local government and allow local authorities down to the most local of levels decide.
Yeah, it is really hard to figure out at a certain level. But, you know, the good news is there are constitutional contours that surround what states and localities can do. And certainly we've seen situations where they probably did run afoul of the Constitution, things like not having a hearing for 2 weeks or, you know, they had a case down in New Mexico where the New Mexico statute, I think, is unconstitutional because it doesn't require a bail to be set for 15 days. And I don't think you can do that. So we've definitely seen some, you know, problems at the local level. But the good news is there have been some lawsuits to try to correct those.
That's incredible, using that example of New Mexico. What would you advocate for a scenario whereby the alleged felon is almost assured of having committed the deed, but one doesn't have the proper criteria and evidence to ask for bail or to charge formally? Are you of the opinion that even though it might be stretching the law and the Bill of Rights, there's a need to be able to hold someone for longer than 24 hours?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole concept of preventative detention in general has been one. Certainly New Mexico, they increased theirs to all felonies. New Jersey, of course, all crimes are eligible for preventative detention. So we agree that there probably should be some movement on the top end and that some of these guys who are not capital offenders but are pretty close should be eligible for preventative detention and not just for more than 24 hours for the whole pendency of the case. And so we have not come out against that. We think that, you know, makes sense. And again, that's a state-by-state issue. You know, we went through this after the Bail Reform Act of 1984, certainly. States looked at the idea that they had preventative detention now, which nobody in the history of this country thought we had till then. And so now I think this is the second time around where states are looking at what should be the criteria. Should it be violent, three-timers, four-timers? What are we looking at here?
We're within 4 minutes of our first break. I'm wondering if we can begin just sketching out the outline of the Walker case. We did it previously in our previous interview. But could we do it again to set the stage for the second part of the program?
Absolutely. So Mr. Walker had a public intoxication problem. He would get intoxicated and walk, through traffic. He did it two nights in a row. The first night he was cited and released. The second night he was arrested, and the bail was set by the schedule, I believe, at $160. He filed a federal lawsuit claiming that he couldn't afford the dollars and that he was incarcerated for too long prior to seeing a judge, and I believe it was like 6 or 7 days. Judge Murphy, in the case, ruled on this equal protection bail theory, and the theory is basically that if one person is held longer than somebody else who has money, and the person who does not have money is held longer, that is an equal protection problem under the Constitution. And so he basically ruled that 1 second longer, if a person is held, that it becomes unconstitutional. And so that decision was appealed by the city. The city essentially came out and said during, you know, the pendency of this injunction, which prohibited bail, that their failure to appear had doubled during this time period. But nonetheless, they appealed the case, saying that, you know, this was not the Constitution and sort of what the Constitution means. And that case was argued. I was in the 11th Circuit. I was actually at the courthouse and listened to the oral argument. It occurred at the tail end of February, and we got an order several weeks ago where the unanimous panel of three judges vacated Judge Murphy's order. And, you know, it really wasn't directly squarely on the equal protection theory. It was more of the scope of the injunction, and then it didn't really define what the Constitution says on this correctly. And so the order was vacated, and now the case is still pending. In fact, the judge just issued an order day before yesterday saying, you know, how do the parties want to proceed at this point? And frankly, the plaintiffs rejected the settlement that was adopted throughout many of the jurisdictions in the South because of Judge Murphy's order. I mean, they got essentially everything they wanted. But I don't think that order would have stood on the merits based on sitting in the courtroom and listening to the questions of the judges. They clearly did not think that there was this instantaneous right to have your indigency reviewed. And they sort of thought that bail schedules, you know, were constitutional and that, you know, what was the outer limit in terms of how long. And questioning by one of the judges, I mean, the plaintiff's lawyers really couldn't get to the point of how long can you be held? How long? 4 hours? 6 hours? When does it become unconstitutional? And so I think that was a problem. The other good question by Judge Baldock, I thought, illuminated the issue clearly was he said, okay, every small town in the South, and he's from Oklahoma, has a town drunk. And we arrest him. You know, it's Otis from, you know, Mayberry, right? We arrest him, but the problem is, under your theory, what if he can't afford bail? And we're just going to release him when he's sober in the morning. Do we have to release him now? And that really kind of got him caught up in this theory, which is, if it's instantaneous and it's based on money, then that guy gets out. And frankly, it was a Friday night, and he just spent his whole paycheck on alcohol. And so, right, he can't afford bail, and so he gets out. And that was, I think, really kind of crystallized the problem with this theory.
We're within 20 seconds of our first break, Jeff. That always strikes me as such an incredible story. When we come back, I'd love to talk about the idea of, in some way, referring constitutional rights to a court case. It seems, more or less, in interpreting the Constitution, it's an exercise in inference, how one feels. So we'll be back in a moment. This is Seldom Said. My name is Robert. Welcome back. My name is Robert. This is Seldom Said, the place where conversation matters. Special guest, Jeff Clayton, the executive director of the American Bail Coalition. This has been a fascinating first 18 minutes. We have two more to go, thank goodness. Jeff, answering that question, do you feel that, in a sense, dealing with civil liberties really amounts to an exercise in inference, an exercise in a kind of nebulous guessing? Or are there finite points that would apply in all cases?
You know, when it comes to bail, it's really hard because there's very little Supreme Court case law. You know, the best example I can give is how long can you sit in jail before a judge has to review your bail that's been set by a bail schedule? What is the constitutional limit to that? And, you know, of course, we hired former Solicitor General Paul Clement, and the answer is we don't know. We know. If we do it within 48 hours, we know we're good because you can't, you know, that's the arraignment, and the Supreme Court has sort of said in the city of Riverside case that, you know, you're safe within 48 hours. But a lot of states have 72 hours. What if it's 5 days? What if it's seven? What if it's 2 weeks? And, you know, the feeling is at some point it gets to be unconstitutional. But then, of course, that all depends on the facts of the case as well because we're asking about an individual defendant, what are their facts and circumstances. So, yeah, it's a lot of guesswork at times, and there's just sort of general limits that are out there, but because we haven't, and bail just hasn't been an issue that there's been a lot of litigation over historically in our country for one reason or the other. And so, yeah, there's a lot of guesswork going on, I would say.
In the majority of these cases where bail is eliminated, obviated, there really is no proviso to go after the person. If that were to be established, Would it be constitutional in your own mind, or would it be simply an exercise in rearresting someone for the same issue?
Well, I think it would be constitutional. I sort of call it the rob one, get one free policy, where, you know, you don't really do anything until they've done it a series of times. And I think that's, you know, not necessarily the right approach. I think when people go on a crime spree, you know, the bails need to go up because they are harming the public and they are telling us that they're going to keep doing it and or they're not going to show up. And so, you know, and that's kind of what we're seeing in New Jersey because there's no backstop. And the other thing that happens is, you know, police just assume, well, these are going to be recidivists anyway, so why do we bother? And I know that is has been an argument against having bail. Well, you know, they're just going to do it again. So, but that's really not the point, you know, of bail in my mind. But, you know, certainly that feeling is out there.
Can you segue into discussing your efforts on bail reform, what you're looking for and how you've approached it?
Yeah, I think really the way I've described, I think what is the best theory for us is you've got issues on the top end of the system, right? And it's what we talked about before. These guys that are just below preventative detention that, you know, we just, one of the cases in New Jersey, the guy had 28 prior convictions, you know. Are these the guys that we want to release? And no. We want to have some movement on and give prosecutors a tool to detain more people at the high end with no bail. On the low end, I think, you know, there's issues with some of these really small bails that don't have any, that don't provide any incentives. And the example I give is a $50 bail. What does that do? That's literally just buying your way out of jail. That doesn't give you an incentive to do anything. And so making adjustments on the low end of some of these cases, citing and releasing some people that, you know, if you're gonna give somebody a promise to appear after you arrest them, why are you arresting them if, you know, there's no reason to do that? And in a lot of cases, we're finding that, you know, you don't need to arrest certain classes of people. And that's a cleaner way to do bail reform than, you know, trying to arrest them and then get them out quickly, all that sort of thing. And then I think, you know, in the middle, I think you want to continue to have bail as an option. And then the other thing that we've been advocating for is due process reforms, like we talked about. You know, can you really wait 15 days to set a bail? And how quickly should you set a bail? And the other thing is having more individualized consideration. You know, people don't like the schedules. I find the schedules to be fair because it's based on the alleged conduct. But people don't like the schedules, and they feel like they're not individualized consideration enough. And so, you know, we advocate for that. If you want to have, you know, courts set bail in all cases, I don't think, you know, most places can afford that. But, you know, that's probably the best way to go. On the other hand, you know, how much is that going to cost? So I think, and how quickly can we get a review from the schedule is the other thing that we talked about. You know, we think 24 hours, you know, somebody shouldn't have to wait that long. This is 2017, and why can't we speed up the criminal justice process? So those are kind of a basket of things that we look at in terms of what would be good reforms.
We had an instance here, Staten Island, in the city, where an individual was illegally selling cigarettes. Mm-hmm. He was accosted and approached by police officers. There was a bit of wrestling on the ground. He argued that he couldn't breathe, and unfortunately, he expired. Are you of the opinion that in certain circumstances, one perhaps might best look the other way?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the question is, you know, can we treat some of these more as sort of civil matters when they really are? And that's really what that is, in a way. It's a crime, but really it's a crime against the marketplace, right?
Yes.
You're illegally selling cigarettes so the cigarette companies can't make their money. And, you know, is that, you know, really one that we don't arrest people for? And obviously every time you make an arrest, there's always a risk that somebody gets hurt. And having defended those cases for years, you know, we saw that where, you know, there's, you got to assess the inherent riskiness of doing an arrest before you, and whether it's worth it before you do it. And sometimes, you know, the police will get in fights with people over the smallest little things that could lead to somebody tragically dying. And then, you know, the question always becomes, why do we do it? And I think that's largely why, you know, police chases ended in the country for the large part. You know, a lot of times they just peel off when the person's going so fast because it just becomes too dangerous.
The idea of making the weight of the issue tantamount to the police officer deciding what to do, that adds a great deal of pressure and tension to the job. How have been the official law enforcement reactions to that thought?
Yeah, no, I think it's been tough for law enforcement lately. And I think, you know, to the extent that we can handle low-level crimes without arrests is better for the police because There's less risk of an excessive force or something goes wrong where the officer gets hurt. And so, I think police would probably agree with me that we need to focus on the violent offenders. We need to focus on people that really are harming people. And we need to focus less on things where it's just sort of crime against the public that really doesn't have that big of an impact. You know, obviously use of drugs, I think that, you know, that as an issue, the ship has sailed on that, where people just realize, well, we shouldn't be prosecuting people for use. And why would we be arresting people that are on drugs if unless they're a danger to themselves, because something could go wrong. So, you know, I think police generally would agree with me that, you know, we should focus on sort of the more violent offenders where there's an actual victim that got hurt.
Is there an opinion developing in Colorado and some of the western states whereby marijuana is not the only formally controlled substance that will suddenly be allowed?
I haven't seen it, and we got a really bad heroin problem. It is destroying communities.
That seems to be nationwide.
Obviously, the meth thing has kind of subsided a little bit, but heroin and opioid addiction is the number one drug problem in the country, and I don't think anybody wants to go there. And I think we need to really seriously get our act together in dealing with that. But I don't see cocaine or any of this other stuff. I just don't see that happening anytime soon.
You mentioned individuals should not be judged on the basis of being a user. How then does that speak to the issue of the individual who is so habitual and desperate for his next involvement that he commits a capital crime? Should he be judged in the same voice as the individual who simply sells to make profit?
I don't think so. And when I talk about use, I'm just talking about an individual user who's, you know, shooting up heroin or whatever. Do we really want to criminalize addiction? And then that's what you have to look at. Obviously, dealing drugs is a whole different ballgame, and those are the people we should go after, because we have to find a way to stop the flow of these drugs. Because once people get on them, it just ruins their life. And, you know, meth, I think, is another good example where if you use it one time, it changes your brain chemistry and you're always an addict. You know, is that the kind of thing we want to have in our community? So, and we don't want to criminalize addicts. We want to get them into treatment. That's the reality. And sometimes, yeah, they are going to go out and commit a major crime. And at that point, no, we don't feel sorry for them. We want to, you know, try to get them treatment if we can. But they've crossed the line when they start harming people because of their addiction.
There seems to be a national ethos developing where reform is an imperative. This must be done immediately. Are you of the opinion that bail reform is a national imperative? We can't wait any longer.
I feel that way because of the politics. I feel like at the end of the previous Obama administration, Justice Department administration, they made this sort of a priority. And I think when this Justice Department gets a hold of this issue, I don't think they're going to be as sympathetic. And I think that will have impacts on how the issue is perceived and whether it's going to draw the kind of federal grant money that it's been drawing. And so I think right now, I think this issue is coming to a crescendo this year. And I think by the end of this year, the momentum will either go to the local level or it'll kind of fizzle for a couple of years. And I think the going to the no money bail system, you know, and we're certainly seeing that down in Texas, is not easy to do. And I think the interest in going for such a big overhaul will wane. But I think right now it's hot, and I think for the next 3 to 4 months, it is sort of make or break on this issue. And what ends up this year, I think, will kind of be the way things stand for a couple of years after that.
Are you optimistic that the new court, as it's constituted, will react favorably to your views?
Yeah, I don't think the trade out for Gorsuch and Scalia is a big one for anybody on any issue, really. I'm not sure that those two guys would have disagreed on much. And so, you know, as somebody said, the quote I read was, you know, the World War III fight will be over the next justice. And I think that's right, because that could change the balance of the court in a dramatic fashion. And so, you know, and obviously now it's just going to be by a simple majority. And so that was another issue there. But for our issue, I think, you know, I think we were on firm ground regardless of who was on the Supreme Court. But, you know, certainly Gorsuch, I think, would be more inclined to sort of go along with the Scalia mold and read the Equal Protection Clause narrowly on this.
with this libertarian philosophy, do you feel that bail reform can be developed as a bipartisan policy?
You know, it's interesting you ask that question because I'm actually going to a forum. I'm appearing at a forum at the University of Pennsylvania Law School next week, and the topic is, can we find common ground? And I'm of the opinion that we can. And, you know, in the state of our politics right now, it's just really disgusting that there's so much personal animosity, you know, and I feel that. I've been on both sides, right? I've worked for the government. I've worked for industry. I've worked for, you know, I was a private attorney. And it really is, if you're in industry right now, you're just perceived as negative. And the other side just feels like, well, you know, you make money, you shouldn't, that's not right. You know, you profit off these poor criminals, and therefore, you know, we're not going to work with you. And I think we're guilty of that as well. We have always been sort of the party of no, forget it, you know, we don't like you, sort of an attitude. And that's just not productive. And so what I'm trying to do is find those common grounds. And a lot of things that the solutions that I brought up today on your show are common ground issues. And I also will say, I think it depends on the state. You know, we were able to fashion a deal recently with the Connecticut governor on bail reform that I think was beneficial to both sides and tightened up the process a little bit and, you know, was a good outcome. And so I think there's a way to get there. But folks just, you know, in our hyper-partisan politics right now, it's not helping us get anything done, I'll tell you that.
There are those who will take the position that what we're trying to do is solve something financially. Those who are indigent and cannot pay bail, where it really is a class issue. And if it's a class issue, it can only be solved politically. Do you subscribe to that fact that there has to be something done with the difference between income development and varied communities before really successful reform can take place?
Yeah, I do. And my, you know, for my money, I think the biggest problem is housing discrimination in this country. You have this concept of a bad neighborhood, and we feel like, well, if you come from a bad neighborhood or you live in a bad neighborhood, you're going to be exposed to crime, and that's the way it is. And until we sort of break that cycle, I don't think we're going to, through bail reform, sentencing reform, criminal justice reform, ever fix the problem. To the idea that there is a class problem in bail, I think we've seen that. Certainly there are folks that are in there that, if they had a rich uncle, for example, you know, or somebody to be the co-signer and reduce the risk for the bondsman, would get out. And so, you know, we certainly have putting forward some ideas to work on that. You know, in Connecticut, I just mentioned, we were able to get the governor to agree to go through a planning process to figure out how bail agents can address some of these cases and get them out on bail, and whether the industry could tax themselves to be able to provide that service to handle some of these cases. So we're of the mind that we can do that. I think the entire criminal justice process discriminates based on class. Rich people can afford better attorneys. Rich people can afford the fines that they have to pay. You know, rich people can get house arrest rather than jail. All this sort of thing, I think, is fundamental, and I'm not really sure what you do about it. I mean, I think you can try to winnow it down, but when it comes down to it, you know, you have a fundamental right to an attorney, and you can choose that. And obviously, if you have a lot of money, you hire Johnny Cochran, and maybe you skate on a crime you committed, you know. So I think fundamentally it's housing discrimination. It's the concept of the bad neighborhood and the cycle of poverty that we got to address in this country. And, you know, as I told one reporter, you know, we can resettle people around the world, but for some reason when it comes to Camden, New Jersey, there's nothing we can do.
That's an incredible statement, and I agree with it, and it's frightening in a way. I'm reminded of there was an old comedy routine with Abbott and Costello, and Abbott asks Costello, what is justice? And Costello responds, it means I'm just as good as you are. And we seem to have come a long way away from that.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I think, you know, everybody in criminal justice right now needs to look themselves in the mirror and say, you know, what is it we could do better to make the process more fair? But as I said, I think we should not deceive ourselves that we can fix things like racism by reforming the criminal justice system, or we can fix some of these problems, because the system is to a place where, as I said, there's widespread housing discrimination in the country, and the criminal justice process starts there. So we really just need to fundamentally back up on the issue of race relations and actually try to get something done on that and try to improve the lot of these people in these neighborhoods, because, you know, we'll never break, like in Chicago, we're never going to break the cycle of gang violence unless we do something about it.
Would you subscribe to the thoughts of some during the 60s and 70s of enforcing movements into schools in predominantly culturally different neighborhoods?
Yeah, you know, I don't know about the whole concept of forcing it. You know, I just think we need opportunities. You know, if I was the Trump administration, I would be building a parking lot in the large sections of the South Side of Chicago and getting people into better housing and better neighborhoods if I could. And I don't know how you would do that. You know, I got criticized for this, making this argument on Facebook, and somebody was, you know, criticizing me because I was criticizing an NFL player who was, you know, donating $100 per sack to help communities. And I'm like, that's not good enough. No. You know, Roger Goodell and the NFL should come out and say, we're going to demolish ghettos in this country, and let's see if we can get something done.
Right. The people with the money give the 5, the 10s, and the 20s and feel good about themselves. But there's so much more that needs to be done. We're within 20 seconds of our second break. This is a fascinating discussion. It almost feels like we're gerbils on wheels running around to get to the same place, but there's still got to be hope. And there are solutions out there. Hopefully we'll talk about them, third segment. This is Seldom Said. My name is Robert. Welcome back. This is Seldom Said, the place where conversation matters. Our guest in a fascinating program is Mr. Jeff Clayton, the Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition. Jeff, I can vouch that this is a fascinating subject and that I was just discussing it on break with my engineer. It's something that's on everybody's mind to some degree and at some level. Can you facilitate a greater understanding by perhaps discussing certain individual cases you have experienced in which you feel the system truly did not work?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think I'll give you a couple examples, and they're just sort of bail-specific cases. But, you know, there's a movement in this country to do, you know, what's called non-monetary bail conditions, things like ankle monitors, things like, you know, and the vendor in Denver is called WizQuiz, which is the drug screening company. To have folks do that instead of posting bail, right, we'll release them and we'll have them do these other conditions. And it sounds great. But I got a call. This was 2 years ago. I remember the call well because it was on December, I want to say the 21st, and it was a lady that was parked in our local jail here. Her family had posted the bail, which I believe was $10,000, and they still wouldn't let her out of jail, and nobody could figure out why. So for a period of days, we put pressure on the jail, we put pressure on the sheriff, and what we finally figured out was she had previously been arrested within the previous year, and she didn't pay her supervision costs for the services she got, you know, to have substance abuse screening and all this stuff. So they wouldn't let her out of jail until she paid it. And that is not permissible constitutionally. And that is happening a lot, and I'm getting calls on that. And certainly I was going to file a habeas petition to have her released from jail on Christmas Eve. I was prepared to drive up to the courthouse, and I got a call from the family, and they just said, you know what, Jeff, we appreciate it. And I was doing it pro bono. They said, you know, we appreciate that, but we want her home for Christmas, and so they paid it. And they didn't have to, and they should not have kept her in jail a second longer because of that. But we see that all the time as an abuse. You know, the other thing I think that's out there that people don't realize is international fugitive recovery. Bail agents, a lot of them deal with this a lot. And we supported legislation, federal legislation, which is trying to put a spotlight on the gaps in returning somebody. And so, for example, I'm working on a case, and I've been working on it for the last 2.5 years. A guy here in Colorado, you know, sexually assaulted two young girls under 12 and was facing 35 years. He posted a significant bail bond. The family put it up. An agent friend of mine posted it. Unfortunately, you know, the courts, they don't take people's passports. A lot of times they just say, hey, good luck. And they don't think, oh, well, we should take somebody's passport. Well, the next day this guy flew to Morocco, which is a known safe haven for sex offenders around the world. And so for the last 2.5 years, we've been trying to get him back. And we got the federal government to agree to talk to the Moroccans, and they have everything set up. But for one reason or the other, for 2.5 years, we can't get the local prosecutor to fill out the necessary paperwork to have this guy brought back. So those would be, you know, a couple of cases, areas that I see a lot where there's gaps in the system and where injustices are allowed to continue. And it's just, you know, bureaucratic policies in many senses.
This next question may sound more hypothetical and spiritual, perhaps, than realistic. But do you feel there is then an absolute system or concept morally of justice? What is fair in that I can find myself doing something in other parts of the world and be cheered on the street?
Yeah, you know, again, justice, I always think is a tough concept. You know, when I was practicing law, you just had a sense of what was right in the case. You could look at your client, and you could look at the situation, and you sort of had a feeling of where it should go. And a lot of times it doesn't go the direction. And, you know, I certainly experienced cases, and perhaps that's because I was defending police officers, where the district attorney was throwing the book at them on a small case. And why were they doing that? And, you know, the justice is definitely in the eye of the beholder. I mean, there's it's hard at times to really say that justice is always being done. Certainly our criminal justice system is overburdened. There's a lack of individual consideration. If DAs had time to actually figure things out more, we'd get to a better result. You know, I had a case where we walked out of the courtroom after taking a plea deal I didn't want my client to take, and the DA said, well, I'm glad he took the deal because the complaining witness was crazy. I don't think I could have won. You know, and when you hear that, you just think, well, you know, why did we do this? And at that point, I just said, do you really think justice was served here? Because I sure don't. And, you know, she really had no answer to that. But if they had more time, I think we could get to more just results. And, you know, if you've ever practiced criminal law, good luck having a prosecutor call you back. I mean, you could have I had a case where I called the prosecutor 35 times and never got a return call. And it's because they just don't have time to consider it. It's a mill. They get a plea. They move on. You know, is that really the best system of justice?
That's an incredible indictment. I'm wondering, it's perhaps, given the time constraints we have, it is time to begin talking about New Jersey's new bail laws. I know Governor Christie recently has been judged allegedly the most unpopular governor in the nation. What are your opinions as to the New Jersey laws? If you could explain them in a very precise
sure.
segment and then give your views.
Yeah, so what has happened in New Jersey, the idea was, as I said, that they were going to lock up more people at the high end without bail because they felt like, why should a guy with a bunch of money get out when he's really dangerous? And so they changed the Constitution to allow for expanded preventative detention. And then they essentially set up presumptions against bail, generally in all cases, and they run people through the risk assessment. What we thought was going to happen, and I've talked to officials who've left the Christie administration, what they thought was going to happen was that bail was not going to be completely wiped off the map, but that it was going to be substantially reduced. And I always told people I thought maybe there would be a third of the bail bonds left after this reform. Maybe there would be half on a good day, but there would probably be a third. Well, I think folks were sort of asleep at the wheel for the several years after it passed because the implementation date was way out. Well, when the Attorney General put out the directive on this, the result of it has been that bail has been completely wiped out, except at the municipal level. But for state cases, there have been a handful of bails posted since January 1. Obviously, in terms of the economic impact, I feel really bad for the agents up there. I mean, a lot of them are filing for bankruptcy. They're moving on. They don't think it's coming back. They don't, you know, they're going to have to find a new line of work. So I feel bad from an economic perspective for those folks, many of whom are, you know, third-generation mom-and-pop bail bond agencies. But what I'm seeing and what I'm confident is happening is that these people at the high end are getting out on promises to appear that would have never happened under the other system. And the hope was that we could preventatively detain these people. The problem is the prosecutors are only winning 55% of the motions to detain, and judges cannot impose a high bail in those classes of cases. And so, you know, you had the guy who's, you know, committed 14 crimes since the beginning of the year. Computer says he's low risk because you can't use the current charge. And so he just keeps getting out. And under the old system, a judge would have said, you know, on about crime number 7, hey, it's a $20,000 bond because you keep doing it, you know, and it would go up to the point where it would stop because nobody in the community would put up for this guy. And so that class of cases there, and in New Jersey, it's indictable crimes, which is basically felonies. The high-risk cases are the ones that are getting out. And, you know, we saw a story, tragically, from last week where a guy was arrested with a firearm, and was a prior felon with, I think, 20-some prior convictions. Under the old system, certainly would have gotten a high bail, but for one reason or the other, he was released within 24 hours and tragically, you know, murdered a person on Sunday and is now, you know, facing first-degree homicide charges. But I don't think that happens under the old system. I don't think he gets out. I think the judge sees him, the bond is high, they put a high bond on him, and he's unable to meet it, and so he stays in jail. And so, you know, that whole issue that we could just replace these high bails with preventative detention is proving to be too hard. And also the Court of Appeals has said, hey, these guys get full discovery. You're going to have a mini trial within 48 hours to keep anybody in jail. And that's a tall order for any prosecutor, even if you have the resources. So I think that's sort of been the problem. I think, you know, the cite and release stuff appears to be working. They're taking some of these low-level guys and just giving them a citation rather than taking them to jail. So that's having an impact. So I think if they made some adjustments to it, it would be okay. But right now I think, you know, they're exposing the community to violence that I don't think they would have seen under the old system.
You feel then it's becoming a stimulus and a catalyst to crime rather than a solution?
Yeah, we heard sort of through a back channel that, you know, in one courthouse, a group of offenders was chanting bail reform to taunt the prosecutors because they knew there was nothing they could do to them. And I think the word has hit the streets that, you know, until you get convicted, you're good. And you can do whatever you want, and you're not gonna get detained. Unless you kill somebody, you're not getting detained, and even then, you may not either.
Do you feel in your own mind then, Jeff, that law and the practice of law is becoming a kind of moral poetry? It's so vague.
Yeah, it's what it's gotten. It's really, I think, maybe it's a generational thing. I don't know. It's so much posturing in law practice. Everybody wants to talk about going to trial, and nobody actually really wants to go to trial. And, you know, I was a former debater, so I loved going to trial. That was the best part of being a lawyer. You know, all the posturing and all that stuff was for the birds and in my mind. But that's really what the practice of law has turned into, is really just a poker game at a certain level.
Given the fact that somebody in the listening audience might be hearing the program, considering it, a young person who really has an ambition to involve himself in law, can you share a bit of optimism with him? We've talked about some of the divergences from what is right and wrong. What advice would you give?
Well, you know, a former Chief Justice that I worked for said public service is the highest calling for a lawyer. And that doesn't necessarily mean working for the government. But I think, you know, that's the one thing, and the reason that I'm glad I went to law school was not to go be a corporate attorney and make a gazillion dollars, which certainly you can do, but to work on a public policy and legal policy issue, you know, where you can impact positive change. And that's out there. And I think really it comes down to a couple different things. I mean, I think maturity, I think you have to realize that, you know, the arc of history doesn't bend very easily. And, you know, you have to devote significant time and effort to an issue to be able to move it in the right direction. But it's out there. There's issues that can be worked on, and there's, you know, I gave one attorney an example of all these fines and fees that are being illegally collected off of defendants to the tunes of millions of dollars. Well, you could stop that with one lawsuit, and there are opportunities out there in criminal justice and every other issue where if you care and you want to work hard, you know, you can have an impact. But if your goal is just to make money and that's it, you know, I would say there's probably easier ways to do that.
If you were sitting across the table from Attorney General Sessions today at this moment, what do you expect of the new administration?
What I would tell him is I think the damage that was caused by this unconstitutional theory needs to be reversed. And we need to make it clear that this was exactly what I think it was, which was a political movement more than a legal movement. We need to inform the chief justices and the judges around the country that were informed by the previous administration that bail was unconstitutional, that bail's different. And I do think, and I've said this, I think the policy on debtors' prisons for post-conviction, so after you've been convicted and let's say you owe $1,000 but you really are poor, you shouldn't be re-jailed unless you willfully fail to pay. In other words, if you hit the lottery and then you don't pay, well, then you could face jail time. But if you truly can't afford it, you know, we can't be incarcerating people for that. And that part of the movement has gotten conflated into sort of bail issues, and we need to separate those two, but not lose sight of the fact that using bail as a collections or, you know, setting up the criminal justice system as a collections is a bad idea. So those would be the two things I would tell them.
Two-part question. Those persons out there in the listening audience, again, who might want to become involved but feel that this will never impact on my life, how may they be involved in your own particular legal struggle to make the bail situation more effective?
Well, one, I would say this does affect people's lives. It affects your friends. It affects your family. The Supreme Court has said that bail offers somebody the opportunity to choose the jailer of one's choice. And the new model of reforms really severs that relationship, the associational component of bail, which is, you know, you're my father, you're my nephew, and I want to be the jailer. I want to take responsibility for you. So I think there's, you know, there's definitely an issue with that. And then I'm sorry, what was the second part of that? I got going on the first part.
How would the person become involved? A person who really is motivated?
I think, obviously you can go to our website to involve yourself with us, and certainly, you know, folks are interested in the issue. I can send materials and all that sort of thing. You know, if you're interested generally in bail reform, there's a lot of associations working on it from various ACLU chapters around the country, a lot of whom I've talked to, and I think there's a lot of common ground on that. And I think, you know, just grassroots in your community, talking to your local officials about bail, what are the problems? And I think, as I said, they vary by jurisdiction. You know, Harris County, Texas, for example, has a big problem because somebody can sit in jail for 2 days after bail bond's posted. And that's a constitutional problem. And, you know, I think if you ask sheriffs and you ask, law enforcement and public defenders even what the issues are, I think that gives you a target of a place to start. And a lot of reforms could be made in just jail policies of, you know, things like, should there be all these collect phone calls? As I tell people, the collect phone calls are probably the biggest racket in bail. Why does it cost money to make a phone? Why does it cost $5 a minute to make a phone call, right? Why is that? Well, we need to monitor the calls. Well, why does the offender have to pay for phone calls? You know, stuff like that. That I think
Indeed. We
could just raise, if you just raise awareness on that, people would say that is ridiculous.
We're within 2 minutes of the end of what has been a fascinating program. These things always go by fast when they work well. I must ask you, Jeff, this is a complex, quite fascinating subject. Is there a book in your future?
You know, I always tell people I should write a book, and I could flavor it with humor because I take Uber a lot, and I don't know if you're familiar with Uber and Lyft, these ride-sharing services.
Yes.
The stories that the drivers tell me about other human behavior is not only entertaining that I could add to the flavor, but yeah, I think the book I would write on this is how I was able to travel the country, how I was able to hear all the different sides on this argument and really boil it down to what is an issue of personal liberty and to structure the bail system in kind of a moderate way, but that, you know, addresses a lot of the concerns that are out there. But yeah, I think there might be a book in my future on maybe another more interesting topic as well. I'll have to come up with some ideas.
It's interesting. I look forward to it. Expect a premier copy on my desk.
Absolutely. Be the first copy.
Thank you. This has been fascinating. I appreciate your time and effort in regard to this entire scenario, the entire question, because I know in the area we are broadcasting from, the East Coast is beset. There are problems that have made Chicago seem calm as a palliative in comparison. So perhaps there are some things to do. One final statement then from you, if you would. Within 20 seconds, are you an optimist about this?
I am. I'm an optimist in general. And I think, you know, for the East Coast, they just need to get some economic development plans going. And that's why the West is doing well and the East is not. You know, is why you need people moving to your state. You need an excitement of industry, and the East Coast is lacking that in certain areas, definitely Connecticut being one.
I certainly appreciate the time. Our guest has been Jeff Clayton, the Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition. Thank you for your appearance.